Let's bring in now Bruce Williamson, who's from the campaign group Rail Future. Good evening, Bruce.
Good evening.
So we're discussing this East Coast mainline. I mean, from the passengers' point of view, as much as anything else, this has been a real mess, hasn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think, what's that old saying about, you know, once is unfortunate, twice is a real disaster. This is the third time that the franchise has failed. And clearly something is very wrong at the heart of the bidding and franchising system, that the old taxpayer has to come to the rescue and bail out the franchise to keep the trains running. What's the problem? Well, I think I'm asking the questions for you, aren't I, Richard?
Well, I was going to say, is there something specific about that line that they keep having so many problems?
I asked a colleague of mine that exact same question just earlier on today. I don't think there's anything fundamental about it other than the fact that it is a biggie. It's the sort of jewel in the crown. You know, It is the main line between London and Scotland, the great north and east, you know, northeast railway, whatever it was, you know, where...
Well, the fact that they're going to call it the LNER again.
Indeed, harking back to the 1930s. So, you know, it seems that I think the train operating companies or the prospective bidders, they certainly have overbid, and that's been the heart of the problem in the past. But equally, I think the Department for Transport is guilty as well, because they scrutinise the bids, they award them, and they probably weren't robust enough at examining them and saying, look, is this sensible, or are they just bidding too much? And maybe greed on the part of the government got the better of them, and they just said yes, when in fact they should have said no.
Do you think this brings into question the whole idea, though, of private ownership, that there's one line, there's not much competition, you've got to be subsidised anyway? Does it really make sense to put it out to private tender?
Oh, well, I think, you know, undoubtedly it does raise questions, and the Labour Party have indeed been making comments along those lines just today. I mean, you know, even if you're not saying we need to renationalise it, you've certainly got to ask why it went wrong and how to do franchising differently in the future. I think Chris Grayling is already talking about doing it in a different way. I can't remember the exact phrase he used, but it was something like a public-private partnership rather than an out-and-out franchising. But the whole franchising system, I think the Conservatives have never really had a sort of clear benchmark by which to judge it. That it's more sort of ideologically driven, that, you know, private good, public bad, rather than saying, well, look, will it produce a better deal for the passengers? Will the trains run on time? And so on and so on.
And I mean, is it round the other way as well, that Labour say, well, public good and private bad? And they're too ideological? I mean, is it possible?
Undoubtedly, yes. I think the same is absolutely true. It's ideologically driven on both sides.
So are there some great privately run railways in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I think, off the top of my head, Chiltern has always had a very good reputation. We know about the bad guys more than we know about the good guys, really, don't we? Because they make the headlines, and obviously Govia Thameslink is the other bad boy at the moment. But you know, the other side of the coin is we're generally speaking using the trains of other franchisees from day to day, and generally speaking getting there on time. So, you know, there certainly is good practice out there as well.
What do you think of the general deal, though, offered to passengers? Because there are other issues as well about the way the railways work. And the biggest one, just asking around today, what upsets you about the railways, people tell me, is the fares. Not just that they're too expensive, but they're confusing, sometimes very cheap, sometimes expensive. You can get all sorts of options, and some of them are available through a machine, some of them are not. I mean, it's a complete farce, isn't it?
It is a nightmare. It's a horrible tangled web, and I certainly agree with you. That's our perception of the big problem in the eyes of the travelling public, is the level of fares and the complexity of the fares. I mean, just the other day I got caught out. You know, I didn't get caught out, but I was trying to put my ticket in the machine. It was rejecting it, and I couldn't understand why it wasn't. You know, and because of the different timetables, the different fares, the off-peak super return is not valid on trains before 1930, all that sort of thing, you know. And it doesn't make for an easy, system for the travelling public. But the solution to this, again, it lies with – with the government, firstly because the government set the level of fares, and generally speaking, what the government is trying to do is to make the traveller pay most of the fares rather than subsidising the railway. So that's why our fares tend to be very high generally, certainly for walk-on fares. You know, we have the most expensive in Europe. But there's another factor as well, which is that our whole railway network is very overcrowded. And so the complexity of the fares has come about partly because the train operating companies are managing passengers to keep them off the most congested trains and put them on the off-peak trains. So, you know, and that's why you have different prices at different times, because, you know, we're, as the passenger, the travelling public, are being managed to suit the needs of the railway. And, of course, it would be much nicer if it was the other way around.
And the other issue that's contentious today, as it turns out, is that the government promise for these rail cards for 26 to 30-year-olds, which were much trumpeted, but actually haven't materialised. There was a trial that seemed to go slightly wrong, and now reportedly they're all fighting over who's going to pay for them anyway, because there's no such thing as a free train ride, so somebody's got to pay. Do you think we're ever going to see these cards? Are they a good idea?
I think you've summed it up very nicely. There was always a problem with these cards, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but I think it's something to do with this, that the discounts available are not valid for season tickets, and that the justification behind this was to help these millennials get to work and help ease the sort of financial burden. So, you know, even before it starts, it doesn't quite work. But, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. Who's going to pay for it? Someone's got to pay for it, because obviously it represents a loss of revenue.
And that crunch question you rightly pointed out just there about, should really just the railway passenger pay the full cost of their fare, or should we all be contributing? What's your view on that one?
Well, no, I think, you know, it's absolutely right that the railways are subsidised. I mean, on the face of it, it seems, you know, fair enough to say, well, rail passengers should pay for the railways because they're using it. But we have to look at the sort of knock-on effects and benefits. It's so complex. I mean, look at a big city, particularly London. It's an obvious example. If you imagine London without railways, it simply wouldn't function. So you can consider them an absolutely essential public service that cannot be replaced by road transport. And, you know, there are other knock-on benefits as well in just easing congestion on the roads. Generally, from an environmental point of view, they produce less pollution and give us cleaner air. They're safer, so fewer people die, and so on and so on. And, you know, when you also drill down into the economics, the odds are sort of stacked very much against railway and very much in favour of the roads. Now, I know that petrol heads will dispute this, and just for the record, I drive a car as well. But for instance, I'll give you just one example. The railway industry has to pay for the British Transport Police. That doesn't come out of general taxation, but the police who police motorists are paid for out of general taxation. So that's just one of many, many examples how the odds are stacked against rail and in favour of road. So it's a very, very long-winded way of saying, yes, they should be subsidised.
All right, Bruce. Thank you very much, Bruce Williamson there from the campaign group Rail Future.